so I'm going to hand those out tonight to you guys.
Okay, thank you.
What this is it's a list of all the goals, strategies for the comprehensive plan.
Okay.
And at the last meeting, the board went through the entire list and identified those that the board is involved with. So what they decided to do at the last meeting was prioritize the ones that they're involved with, and obviously you don't know which ones they have. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if, I have those in my copy, but what I'll do is I will make a list of the ones that the board identified for their purposes and email them to you.
Fine, that'll be fine. Yeah. Great, thanks.
Yeah, sounds good.
I forgot to bring them with me.
Yeah, I didn't bring them either.
So you just want a table further discussion on that for now?
Yeah, let's. Do we need to make a motion and vote on it, or just table it?
You can go ahead and motion a second.
Okay. I'll make that motion. The motion that we table it pending further information.
Second. Vote. Yea or nay? Unanimous. Item B, proposed amendments to Appendix C, subdivisions.
Well, I gave you, in your packet, I gave you copies of the proposed amendments. This is not something that you have to act on because Appendix C is an ordinance that you're involved with, but in terms of amendments, you don't really have any direct involvement, but it hasn't been taken to the ordinance committee yet, so I wanted to get your feedback. Because it does involve some of the review standards, but the copy I gave you is not the most current one. I have another copy because there's been something added that wasn't in. Take one pass around. So I'll point out what that is in a second.
So here we just throw.
No one says use.
My homework gone. Thank you. I never listen. That path stays. This path stays. Yes.
I guess we can just tear that one up.
I have an extra copy, Jim, if you'd like one.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, I think it is a lot.
Thank you.
So, the proposed amendments to the subdivision ordinance are summarized on the first page. It's a proposed amendment to correct a conflict with the state subdivision law, to provide for the use of gravel roads, and to update phosphorus control measures. So, the amendment reads as follows. There's actually no changes on the first page. I reproduced the entire section that's impacted by the amendment, but you don't get to the actual amendment until the second page. And that has to do with a change in subdivision law that was made in the statute. There was a condition in the law that allowed a municipality to review a subdivision involving leased dwelling units if it had been determined that.
I gotta close that door.
Want to
close it?
Yes, please. If it had been determined that the municipality had an ordinance in place that was adequate to review those types of subdivisions, and we had determined that we did, in fact, Appendix K or land use ordinance documents that those types of subdivisions can be reviewed as a site plan review and not a subdivision review. But the state amended the law and took that exception out. So the change in our subdivision ordinance reflects that change in state law. And on page 2, section 3.6 is deleted because it's no longer allowed under state law. And then 3.7 and 3 are just renumbered to remain consistent. So now if somebody wants to add 3 apartments in their building or build a 3 apartment brand new building, it's going to be reviewed as a subdivision, not a level 2 review.
Oh, interesting.
Any questions about that?
No.
That's just keeping in line with the new law.
That's right. Yeah.
Good, thank you.
Section 8.3, streets. This is a change that just came up recently. I was having a discussion with a property owner who owns property out with frontage on Brewer Lake. And he was asking questions about developing a small subdivision with lots that had short frontage. And I pointed out to him that currently any road that's proposed for a subdivision is required to be paved. And he wondered why that would be without any ability to make exceptions. And the Appendix C specifically says the planning board cannot waive the requirements for asphalt on roads that are proposed for a subdivision. His subdivision would utilize an existing camp road, and he would extend it to reach his property, and the camp lots or house lots he's proposing would be accessed that way. If he were to bring that plan to you today, he would have to pave the entire road from where it intersects with the public road. So the existing camp road and any extension he made to it would all need to be paved.
So not just the new stuff would need to be paved.
Right. Yeah.
The only road that fits that description would be Wilderness Way, correct?
Well, no, we have several roads that could be used to access properties that might have subdivisions proposed.
Yeah.
Strickland Ridge Road is another one.
Yeah. Okay.
There's Wilderness Way.
There's a few out there, but very few actually have camps.
Upper Long Pond Road.
That are in Bucks Corner. Some of them lead out to Brewer Lake, but very few are actually in Bucks Corner. Yeah.
In this case here, the property is on that neighborhood and is accessed both by Strickland Ridge Road and Old Wilderness Way.
Yeah.
But that's the way he proposed to extend.
Huh.
Because there's a shorter route to come down Wilderness Way to get to his property than it is to go down Strickland Ridge Road. He built a timber harvesting road off Strickland Ridge Road, a well-built road. And he has ideas in mind about possible further development down there. But having to pave the road is problematic because it doesn't make the project cost-effective.
Right.
So this language here allows the planning board to accept a gravel road. And there are two points. The board may approve the use of a mineral surface for a proposed street that does not intersect with a public way, provided that the street design will comply with an approved stormwater management plan for the subdivision. So if you have a proposed street that intersects with a public road, it will have to be paved. Royal Ridge, for example, is an example of a subdivision road that intersects with a public street. That road was required to be paved, and I think rightly so. But if you have a road that's out in the boonies, and it doesn't directly connect to a public road, and this is a scenario that we're dealing with on this property out there, is why require that to be paved if the road complies with stormwater management requirements?
Name a point that it doesn't connect with it.
Ask me again. Yeah, what was that?
Name a point on a road that does not connect with a public road.
A point on a road that doesn't connect.
I mean, wouldn't everything eventually connect?
Everything
comes off a public road. I don't see any.
Right, but that first exception I'm reading, it applies to roads that don't intersect.
Not directly.
Right.
They don't,
yeah, they don't intersect.
A road off a road off a road off a road.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Like, for example, Strickland Ridge Road intersects with Bucks Mills Road, which is a public road. But the road that he built to get to his property does not intersect with Bucks Mills Road. It intersects with Strickland Ridge Road.
So this road in question could intersect.
So is Strickland Ridge Road paved?
Right. It's not.
No, it's not.
So this road...
And it intersects with a public way.
Right, but in this case here, the subdivision is being proposed off of Strickland Ridge Road, on a different road altogether.
Okay.
So this language here would allow you to accept a gravel road in that scenario. The second one It deals with existing roads. The board may approve the use of an existing private road finished with a mineral surface to provide access to a proposed subdivision, provided that the road is improved to the extent necessary to comply with the requirements of Chapter 10, Roads and Streets, and to comply with an approved stormwater management plan for the subdivision. So that, all that's saying, essentially, if you want to put a subdivision on Strickland Ridge Road, we'll use that example again, you've got to bring that road up to standards, except it doesn't need to be paved.
Yeah, oh, okay. Shoulders, surface gravel,
yeah,
base gravel.
Whatever stands are in chapter 10 that apply to road construction.
The bottom of the pavement.
Yeah.
Basically. Okay.
And the road would need to be part of an approved stormwater management plan for that subdivision.
Yeah, ditching and...
So those are two changes that are proposed for street requirements for subdivisions. And that just came about yesterday. As a matter of fact, he was in my office, and I asked the question, well, why can't you allow a gravel road to be part of a subdivision if it made sense to do that? And so these two scenarios, I think, make sense. But
gravel roads shed less phosphorus, I believe, than paved. So it's an improvement in a way, oddly. It is. Nice.
Remember bridge development, the region just beyond the transfer station up in there?
Royal Ridge, yeah.
Yeah. Now, originally, that development, I wouldn't have minded that just be a gravel road for, we allowed it to be till so many lots were developed and then he had to pave it. So.
I don't recall that condition, but that was back when, it still is, a requirement for any subdivision that involves a new road. It has to be paved.
Yeah. Well, he did build a gravel road and then developed a few of the lots and then paved.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any harm in that.
Yeah. But with these changes, it's still going to be required. If you're proposing a subdivision that involves a new road that intersects with a town road, you still have to pave it.
Yeah.
And that can't be waived.
Yeah.
I think we allowed him to do face paving on that as he sold lots, didn't we? I mean, we did something special on that one.
Yeah, we did.
That made it happen.
You get a lot of heavy traffic in there when you're developing it and stuff, so it's actually a good idea to postpone the paving until a proportion of it is, you know. You can put a time limit on it or something. 2 years of development, then you pave it, or 60% develop. But the understanding is, yes, it will be paved, but I don't know. You hate to pave something and then have it torn up and then have to pave it again. But you get no life expectancy out of it, so. That's not good for the developer or the town. So,
you okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. The next one is in section 811, the natural resources section. The actual changes start on the next page. And this is an update to reflect the changes that DEP has made to their phosphorus control regulations.
Yeah.
It references the main stormwater management design manual. As being applicable when determining phosphorus export from a proposed subdivision.
Yeah. That is section, the new one they're recommending.
What's that?
That's the new one they're recommending to replace the older.
Yeah, that's what's in place now. Yeah.
So
the MSMD manual.
Do we change the, because the comp plan uses the older one. I guess you can't update the comp plan. Anyways, okay. So that's interesting.
I think the date of the new one is 2011. I didn't put the date in here because we'd have to revise the ordinance every time the date, guide was updated. So I just stated that the most recent edition is the one that applies.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And I added in section 811.8 per year, which for some reason was missing, but that's an important, I think, point to make is the phosphorus export is pounds per acre per year.
Yep.
The numbers, by the way, have not changed in the guide. The manuals have exactly the same numbers that were in the older one from 1992. But as you read down through in Section 811.9, it says Section 811 must be updated as required by amendments to the comprehensive plan, reflecting changes in expected development rates. The comprehensive plan, I don't think, expresses any concern about development rate changes in phosphorus.
I'd have to look at it. It does mention phosphorus, but I don't know if it specifically does it in that manner.
811.10, 811.11, 811.12 are deleted because it makes reference to two review methods that were in the old guide but are not in the new one. The new guide has, and I copied this for you, as an alternative method for small commercial type developments. 3, 4, 5.
So this is superseded by the new management, stormwater management design manual?
The deleted text is not relevant any longer because it's talking about something that is in an older plan that's not, that's been removed and changed.
Thank you.
The alternative method for small commercial type developments that are located within designated growth areas is what the new manual refers to. And that involves DEP. DEP has to get involved in whether or not this alternative method is appropriate to use for a proposed subdivision or any sort of development. So that's why all that text has been deleted. And the last change is just replacing reference to the technical guide with the wording MSMD manual.
Cool.
Any questions or concerns about Appendix C changes?
You say this is going to the Ordinance Committee?
It's on the agenda for the Ordinance Committee on May 10th. They have devoted 2 hours to review not just this one, but there's a few other things on the agenda to review. Including the next amendment on our agenda tonight is an amendment to Appendix K. It's on the planning board, the Ordinance Committee agenda. They were going to review it and make their recommendations back to the planning board because, I don't know if you recall, but there was a charter change made. The charter change now requires that proposed amendments to Appendix K come from the planning board and are directly reviewed by the town council. They no longer go to the ordinance committee. That's not to say the ordinance committee can, they can start a review and then refer to you what the changes they think should be made. But the end result of a proposed amendment will come directly from this board to the town council for their review.
Right, right.
Okay. Want a copy, John?
I have a problem.
It's been changed. No, it's been changed since it was posted on the internet. It was an initial change made to this one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All waste paper.
Yeah. So what I handed out to you in your packet, I have added. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah.
So this first reading is.
The one in your packet, you want to disregard that one. And I'll point out what I added in just a moment here. So, the summary says it's a proposed amendment to Appendix K Land Use Ordinance to remove a conflict with the state subdivision law, which I talked about earlier, to add regulations and the definition for tiny houses, to clarify stormwater management plan requirements. And this next one is the one that's been added. To clarify street frontage requirements for lots in a shoreland district and to address parking requirements for dwelling units in the downtown and downtown shoreland district. So the first amendment deals with this table here, housing land uses. And if you look at note E9, wherever note E9 is in the table applies to dwelling units.
Mm-hmm.
And the note has been amended to delete level 2, replace it with subdivision review. So that just simply reflects what the change is being made in Appendix C to remove the conflict with state law. The next page changes multifamily dwellings from an L2, a level 2 review, to no review done under Appendix K. That's the zero. The zero means you don't review it under Appendix K. But a note has been added, E14, which is actually on the next page. Multifamily dwellings are subject to compliance with Appendix C subdivision ordinance. So wherever multifamily dwellings are allowed and whatever zoning districts are allowed in, you got to do a subdivision review, no longer a level 2 review. And then further down, you see where tiny houses, a row has been added for tiny houses. And this one, I want to get your thoughts on this. You see there's a lot of X's that are shown right now where tiny houses would not be allowed.
Yeah.
And the ones that I'm starting off with as allowed uses are the Route 15 Residential Commercial District, which is up Route 15. The R1 and R2 District, which covers a lot of area in the back parts of town. But no shoreland zone and no areas in the compact area, no zones in the compact area are being proposed, unless you think they should be. You know, so are there other zones in the town where you think tiny homes should be allowed, other than I've identified?
Well, the idea behind all the this whole tiny house movement is because people are trying to save money and either get off the
grid. Save energy.
Say what?
Save energy.
Right. Yeah. Save energy, all kinds of things. So to put a lot of restrictions on that almost restricts that whole movement.
Yeah. This is just property rights tax. This is touch nuts.
So what's your suggested change?
As long as they're hooked up to a sewer and some source of fresh water.
What's unique about the definition of tiny house?
It's less than 400 square feet. 400 square feet and smaller would be a tiny house by definition.
10 by 40 trailer.
Tar paper shack.
Did I read somewhere that a tiny house must be on the foundation?
Yes, right here.
Can it be on a pad?
Yes.
Well, you have tiny houses that are built on frames, trailer frames, and they're
and I see that's addressed around the trailer frame.
But I'm suggesting that to be recognized as a dwelling in the town of Bucksport, a tiny house has to be on permanent foundation. It can't be on wheels.
Okay. Which would
seasonal? Yes.
Recreational vehicles. And that's something that can be clarified that a tiny house can be used for seasonal occupancy. I don't know if it's I don't think that's clearly stated at this point in time, but to get back where tiny houses should be allowed, is it your preference that they should be allowed wherever one family dwellings are allowed, which are stated just above that? You see the rule there for one family dwellings. Downtown shoreland, C1 district, and there's several shoreland districts where they're allowed. They're allowed on Route 1, and of course the R1 and R2 district, and even in the village district there, one family dwellings is allowed. Should tiny houses also be allowed in all those areas? It's up to you.
I would think so. That the size of someone's house or their ability to live and what they could afford or what they're attempting to do shouldn't necessarily be determined by their location. if you had a piece of land or had the ability to obtain a piece of land for a reasonable price and wanted to put a reasonable house on that location.
Yeah, and you couldn't afford a 100,000 square foot home.
Right.
What's the difference?
Then you shouldn't be restricted by the fact that it's not allowed on that particular street or in that section.
If it conforms to everything else, I mean, right. Why not? I guess that's my take. Why not?
Could it negatively impact the value of your house? If someone puts one next to your house on just a tiny little minimum 10-foot setback,
does it matter? I mean, if it meets code.
No, I'm just raising the question.
Yeah, no, it's a
that would be the only question I would have. Would it affect the property value of my frickin' house?
Right.
Good thought.
And, I don't know what the facts are.
And what?
Maybe it'll increase.
Right. And what sort of, taxing scenario is assessed with that?
What's that? Here in town. I'm in a housing development.
Yeah.
But there are covenants. You can't build anything less than 1,080 square feet. So.
Right.
You know, that automatically does it. But that could be up to the developer. As far as covenants on what can go on the lots, minimum sizes, etc., doesn't have to be a government telling you.
But also with that, if it was a permanent dwelling, if it was someone's permanent residence, and if it was in town, then your comment of being hooked up to water and sewer would be absolutely accurate. You wouldn't want a tiny house that is not hooked up to those facilities being somebody's permanent residence located within the means of them being hooked up to those types of things.
An outhouse.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them have bio toilets.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. Yeah.
It does away with.
Yeah, that does away with those types of things. Yeah, that's a good point.
We'll get to the standards for tiny homes are further in.
Yep. Oh, good.
So, if I understand the board correctly, you'd like to allow tiny houses in the same districts where one-family dwellings are allowed, without exception.
Follow the code. If it's not in a
subdivision, yeah.
Well, what's the difference with subdivision?
Violate the covenants.
Well, if there's covenants.
Oh, you mean the existing subdivision?
Right.
If somebody proposed a tiny house subdivision.
Yeah, you could do a proposed tiny house subdivision.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
You know,
wouldn't that be interesting?
That would really.
Yeah.
Does anyone have one yet?
No.
I don't know.
You ever go off the road, turn off the road on Route 1 going down from Belfast and go through Northport?
Yeah.
There's a whole little village in there.
Oh, yeah, that's been there forever.
Yeah.
They go for $100,000, little tiny houses, built like dollhouses.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You can smell salt water down in there, so probably that's where they're going.
And also, the Under 500 Club was started in the 70s.
Oh, really? So this is no new movement.
The ones in Belfast have been there forever.
Yeah.
What's that little settlement called down there?
So do we need to do a vote on that, Jeff?
Oh,
is that
Temple Heights?
Are we at that point?
And there's another name I can't remember.
Wait, do we get the attention of the board again here?
Okay.
I used to work there. I should know the name. Mm.
Do you want to make a formal motion and vote on that change? Or do I have a consensus of the board you want to change the tiny house restrictions to those that apply to one-family dwellings as to where they can go?
I'd make that motion.
Yep.
Yes.
I would.
Okay, I will do that. And just to wrap up that section, there's a note E13 in that road, and the note says that tiny houses that are built on the frame of a motor vehicle or trailer are prohibited.
Where is this?
Note E13.
Okay.
Tiny houses that are built on the frame of a motor vehicle or trailer are or prohibited. So the fifth wheel trailer type tiny houses that people are buying the trailers, building the tiny house on these trailers. That,
yeah, so if you have a pickup,
yeah,
with a, you know, frame, and you're building your tiny house where your bed would go normally,
right. Yeah, yeah.
You see those all the time. That those would not be allowed to be used as a dwelling.
Right, right. On the, but it says motor vehicle or trailer.
Or trailer, right. So you have a trailer frame,
yeah,
you put your tiny house on that, and you haul it with a pickup or whatever.
Yeah. And that would be prohibited.
Those are campers, aren't they?
Basically.
Yeah,
what's not being addressed here, and could be, is the seasonal use of those types of structures.
Yeah.
Well, if they're on a frame and they're mobile, yeah, people are not using them to stay at home. They're used to move.
I think they probably... I mean,
everybody's got RVs. You call it an RV, you call it a tiny home, it's still the same thing.
It's mobile.
Right. Right. If it's mobile, it's just constructed differently.
I don't care if they call it a tiny house or an RV, it's still...
So the definition of recreational vehicle is a self-propelled motorhome vehicle designed for seasonal use as a temporary sleeping and living quarters for one or more persons. So it's not technically a motor home. We think a motor home, that's a structure that's been built to a standard. It's been manufactured to a standard.
Campers.
Right. Yes.
Also, but it can be moved under its own power.
But perhaps we could tweak the definition of recreational vehicle to include, to make it clear that
tiny houses
built that are mobile fall into that category.
Yeah. Mm,
that's a smart idea.
And to remove that, just to make them, just to be clear, am I correct in saying that a mobile home now, a actual mobile home, is if you remove the wheels from it, then you fall within, then it is a mobile home. It's not classified as something movable, correct? Once the wheels are removed. So would that fall into the same category?
Well, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything in the installation standards for mobile homes that requires you to remove the tires.
Okay.
It needs to be blocked up.
Right, okay.
Before you can occupy it, but the tires, I think, can stay on it.
Okay. Yeah. So it would be the same thing for a tiny home. I have this image stuck in my head of these fifth wheel trailers that people build these houses on. And I've seen some of them look quite nice. And I'd hate to put any unnecessary restrictions on some of these nice little tiny houses that are built on some of these trailers. That,
well, if we call them recreational vehicles, they can be used for seasonal occupancy in Bucksport, but not for year-round.
Okay.
No, I'm not.
Just like a camper. A camper can be lived in seasonally, but not year-round.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'll make that change to the recreational vehicle definition. All right, so move on. Okay. Section 12, environment standards, and the actual change is on the next page. That clarifies that if you require secondary documentation to address any stormwater management requirements, that documentation is provided through the main stormwater management design manual that we just talked about in Appendix C. That's the document that the applicant would have to use to satisfy your stormwater management requirement plans. Mm-hmm. It's not clear right now about what they're supposed to use, but this actually clarifies that. And then Section 13, specific land use standards, this is where the actual standards that pertain to tiny houses are located. Tiny houses are subject to compliance with the applicable requirements of the Maine Uniform Building and Energy Code. There's actually an appendix that was added to the MUBEC specifically for tiny houses, and it addresses things like stairways and loft areas, because typically tiny houses have lofts that are accessed by ladders almost. And if you apply the International Residential Code to that, they fail. They can't, because you can't use a ladder to access a loft area under the IRC, but under the appendix you can. And the changes we're making to Chapter 5 recognize that we are going to apply that appendix that pertains to tiny houses in Bucksport. 13.6.14.2, tiny houses must be supported by a foundation constructed in accordance with the applicable requirements of the International Residential Code, as adopted by the state of Maine. Tiny houses must be provided with the minimum plumbing fixtures required for a one-family dwelling, as identified in the Uniform Plumbing Code adopted by the state of Maine, except that a clothes washer hookup is not required. And the reason why I added that is because those take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
And you're not going to find those typically in a tiny house.
Right.
And the last one, tiny houses must be provided with a connection to a subsurface wastewater disposal system approved by the Bucksport Plumbing Inspector, or a connection to the public sewer approved by the Bucksport Sewer Department.
Oh, perfect.
Power is not addressed. It's not addressed for dwellings. You can have power from the CMP, or you can have solar power. You can wind power.
Generator.
No, not generator. No. Generators are for backup power, but not for continuous power. No. They're for emergency use only. And then the next section is just renumbered because this section on tiny houses was added in there. All right, so the next one is a change that I think should be made, depending on what your thoughts are, to address. We already have a requirement that allows existing public parking spaces in the downtown and downtown Shoreland districts to satisfy the requirements for any commercial or non-commercial use of a property, existing building on Main Street. It doesn't address, however, the parking requirements if you're going to add a dwelling unit in these buildings on Main Street. And because of the changes that have been made in the dimensional standards that apply to the shoreline zone we're in here, we could start seeing dwelling units in buildings where it wasn't possible before because of the dimensional standards that prohibited it.
Right.
So the changes are: existing public parking spaces in the downtown and downtown Shoreland district shall fulfill the parking requirements for any existing or proposed commercial or non-commercial use of an existing building on Main Street that's not provided with an on-site parking lot. Any public parking lot allowing overnight parking shall fulfill the parking requirements for any dwelling unit that may be allowed in an existing building occupied with a commercial or non-commercial use. So what that's saying is, for example, the Chamber building is changing hands. It's going to be privately owned. I think the new owner is considering having a commercial use on the first story and putting an apartment above. Right now, the ordinance requires them to provide a parking space on that lot, and it's not possible. So this change would allow a parking in a public parking lot that allows overnight parking to satisfy the requirements for parking in that case there. And by the way, there is a change that's also being proposed to chapter 12 that affects the restriction of overnight parking in this parking lot here. Right now, there's no overnight parking allowed in this parking lot. Although it has happened, I think motel patrons park there a lot overnight.
Yes.
And one of the conditions of the sale of the Chamber property is to provide two parking spaces for the owner. And those parking spaces are going to be taken out of the parking that we have here now that's being used by employees. But we need to amend Chapter 12 to recognize that you can do that. You can allow parking, overnight parking, in designated spaces in this parking lot. So that's coming to the council for consideration.
Mm-hmm. So is there, and now I haven't read it yet, obviously, where I just received it, but is there going to be more parking as part of the town's comprehensive plan to develop more public parking space? I know there was a thing with the Nason property off Central Street that was going to continue to get developed. Is that coming to fruition or not?
I'm not sure what the status of that is, Steve. How much more public parking needs to be provided downtown? I don't think it's been really closely studied. If the parking we have now is sufficient for the foreseeable future or not, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I know the building that was torn down was going to be converted to parking.
Yeah, and it may still be. It may still be.
The town hasn't approached the planning board to do it yet.
Right, I was going to point that out. You have to approve that expansion of parking there. So Are you okay with this change, though, pertaining to how parking is provided for dwelling units? Not apartment building, dwelling units in commercial buildings only. So if you had...
Well, commercial building is probably an apartment.
We had a building downtown that with the proposed change of use was to a multifamily dwelling. This isn't going to help them. They need to provide parking on the property, unless they are able to get a variance or something like that. But this only addresses buildings, commercial buildings, where the owner wants to add an apartment in the building and has the space to do it.
I see no issue with that.
The only issue I have that I see often is just in the wintertime when our parking
plowing is snow removal.
Plowing and snow removal, because I've been the one for the last several years in the middle of the night.
Yeah, knocking on doors to take off and work.
Right, looking for someone to move their car because it doesn't fit. They can't have it there because it's in public parking and it doesn't fit in with.
Didn't really thought of that.
That's the only issue I have with that is if. Does that help things? I don't see it helping that much necessarily.
Well, keep in mind, it's only when there's been a... Well, the change in Chapter 12 only pertains to this parking lot.
Oh, okay.
So parking lots now that prohibit overnight parking other than this one will remain this that way.
Yeah, okay.
And we have some parking lots that require odd and even.
Right.
You know, park on one side and odd days and the other side and even days.
So, but being the change to this parking lot, where would this parking lot stop and start in regards to the fitness center or the medical center here and the parking that's used for the hotel?
That parking on the hotel is on public property, it's town-owned property.
It is, okay.
Yeah. So if the town wants to continue that practice of allowing them to for their motel patrons to park there overnight if there's no room in their parking lot, then that if they approve the change to Chapter 12, they'll put up signs that say this is for overnight parking, this area here is for overnight parking.
Oh, okay.
And the same will apply to the chamber building. There'll be signage that says overnight parking for tenant use or whatever, something like that.
Oh, okay. All right.
So most of these that are on the waterfront here, the no overnight parking signs will remain there.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. All right, that makes sense then.
Okay. I need a question with E6.
E6. Where are you? What page is that?
On 9-5.
E6, okay. And what's your question?
Okay, I live up in Woodland Heights, and I don't see why multi-family dwellings would be not allowed. Of course, you've got mostly residential lots, but somebody approached us and wanted to put 50 trailers in there as part of that subdivision, and that wasn't brought up then.
Yeah.
What's come about here?
This is a current requirement. This isn't a proposed change. E6 is in the ordinance now.
I've never seen Woodland Heights exempted from.
It's been in our land use ordinance since 2010.
You turn off up towards Little League Field, and you went. And on the left side is Eastman, that lot. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not a very good lot. It needs to be cleaned up, really. And but that lot actually would make for a nice 8-10 unit row house there.
Yeah. I think you'll find, Ed, that the streets that are listed in E6 all are subdivision streets. Yeah. And the subdivision has a covenant that allows for one family dwellings only. So I think that's the rationale behind stating and clearly in the ordinance that you can't.
Well, that street abuts a property that is not a subdivision. So I don't see
Well, the eastbound, that's access through Central Street.
Yeah.
So that's not a...
It is private, but
so.
Actually, that lot fits pretty good coming out. If it had more, you know, if you were looking at controlling traffic, I'd rather have Woodland Heights than another 100 feet up the road as far as controlling traffic in and out. Mm-hmm. So,
did you have a suggested change to that footnote?
No, actually, I think that lot is could be developable. It's a relatively odd shape lot, but right now it's rather contaminated, I would say.
That property is in the Village District, and multifamily dwellings are allowed in the Village District. So,
but see, that side of that road is that lot.
Yeah, I know. But it's access from Central Street. Wow.
And then up beyond the water tower, in that area, behind the original lot survey of Buck Estates, that area wasn't part of the original plot plan. And that's where somebody wanted to put 50 trailers in there or whatever. So we didn't seem to have a problem with that.
Do you have a proposed change?
No.
Not right yet. Maybe but we could revisit that maybe at a later date. Where were we? Parking, yeah. So are y'all okay with the changes to section 13.15.8.7, parking lot?
I lost that one.
Yep.
Okay, moving on. This is the change that was added after the packet had gone out and after the proposed amendment had been posted to the website for the ordinance committee. And that's because of another issue that's brought up by the same property owner out on Bucks Mills Road on the Brule Lake lots. Currently, if he wanted to propose a subdivision lot that fronted on Brule Lake or any water body, you have to have X number of feet of shore frontage. In this case, on Brule Lake, it's 200 feet. The back line of that lot, however, would need to be 400 feet wide because it's a subdivision. And the street frontage and lot sizes are doubled in the R2 district, which is the underlying district in that area. It didn't make much sense to say you only have to have 200 feet on one end of the lot, but you got to have 400 feet on the other end because the ordinance says that. So this proposed change addresses that.
Okay.
By saying that any lot that fronts on a street must have a minimum street frontage that's no less than the minimum shore frontage required for the lot. So again, if you need 200 feet of shore frontage, you only need 200 feet of lot width on the back line.
I'm trying to think how many lots you would lose if it's 200 at the shore and 400 at the road. I mean every lot's going to be shaped.
Yeah, it'd
be pie.
It's crazy.
So the language that requires that has been deleted and replaced with a proposed language that addresses that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense.
And the last change is just a definition of tiny house dwelling is 400 square feet or less in floor area, excluding lofts, is a tiny house by definition.
Cool. 20 by 20.
It still create a little bit of a problem with irregular frontage on a lake. Your base is the frontage, you get 100 feet, that will be back.
Yeah, I know.
Could be 50 feet.
Yeah.
I suppose it could go the other way, you're right. It could be sort of like this. Yeah, it could. But that would solve it.
Got to define frontage is measured in a straight line from point to point.
Are you going to crawl up and down on the rocks on some of these places in the winter?
How do you measure short frontage?
Typically, you measure
along
the high water line.
Yeah. A lot following the high water.
Yeah.
So as you may know, any proposed change to Appendix K requires a public hearing conducted by this board.
Yeah.
So with those changes that you've asked me to make, would you like to go ahead and schedule a public hearing for the next meeting?
Might as well.
Or would you rather me make the changes and bring them back to you for just a second review before you do that?
I don't think we'd need that second review, would we?
I don't either.
Don't we have to have a hearing on these proposed changes anyway?
Yes, you're going to hold a public hearing on the proposed amendments to Appendix K. Right. As amended, after discussions tonight from the board, the changes you asked for, I'll make those changes, and that's what will be advertised for the public hearing.
Because this has already been advertised? Or not?
Well, it was posted with the agenda for the ordinance committee.
Yeah.
Just because of the timing, they were meeting before you, but that meeting was canceled, so they haven't had a chance to look at this yet, but now they won't have a chance at all. The full council will be reviewing it.
Full council meets when?
It won't be until June, because your public hearing will be at your June meeting, and then the council will be doing their first reading of the ordinance probably at the first Thursday meeting that they have in June, and then hold their public hearing. They have to hold a public hearing also, which will be probably the second meeting in June, and then they'd act on it then. So I'll schedule the public hearing for the June meeting.
Yep.
Okay.
Cool.
Did you have any other changes you wanted to make to the land use ordinance while we're at it? Anything of interest to the board to address? Okay.
Item 9, any more discussion? Move to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.